by email or whatever you think is the quickest. I didn't exactly jump to it. I was trying to think faster than Khalil was killing people. The knish, mustard, sauerkraut, and red wine were churning in my tummy. I didn't see any immediate reason to alert my colleagues around me or to alert Washington. I'd already established that four men were dead and didn't need cover. Callum was alive and covered. That left the problem of finding Wiggins, which Kate and I were more than equipped to handle. I said to her, "I'm going to call the FBI field office in Los Angeles, or do you want to make that call?" "I would if you knew how to use the computer better. I'll look for Wiggins." She added, "Ask for a man named Doug Sturgis. He's the deputy agent in charge. Mention my name." Right. So I called the Los Angeles field office, identified myself as working with the New York Anti-Terrorist Task Force, which usually gets people's attention, and I asked for Doug Sturgis, who came on the line. He asked me, "What can I do for you?" I didn't want to confuse the guy with facts, nor did I want him on the horn with Washington, but I wanted him to help. I said, "Mr. Sturgis, we're looking for a male Caucasian named Chip Wiggins, first and middle name unknown, age about 50, last known address is Burbank." I gave him the last known and added, "He's a possible witness in a high-profile case that might involve international terrorism." "What case is that?" "Why is everyone so nosy?" I replied, "The case is sensitive and under wraps at this time, and I'm sorry I'm not at liberty to identify it right now, but Wiggins may know something we need to know. All I need is for you to look for him and take him into protective custody and call me ASAP. I gave him what little I had on Mr. Wiggins. There was a silence, then Mr. Sturgis asked, "Who is targeting him? What group?" "Let's say Mideast. And it's important that we find him before they find him. When I get more details, I'll call back." Mr. Sturgis didn't seem inclined to do my bidding, so I said, "I'm working with Kate Mayfield on this." "Oh." "She said you were the man to call for help." "All right. We'll do what we can." He repeated Wiggins' last known address and phone number and said, "Give Kate my regards." "Will do." I gave him my and Kate's direct dial numbers and said, "Thanks." I hung up and dialed LAPD missing persons. I ID'd myself, asked for, and got a supervisor, a Lieutenant Miles. I went through my slightly evasive rap and added, "You guys can do a lot better job than we can in locating a missing person." Lieutenant Miles said, "This can't be the FBI I'm talking to." I chuckled politely and informed him, "I used to be NYPD, homicide. I'm here to teach basic law enforcement." He laughed. "Okay, if we find him, we'll ask him to call you. That's all I can do if he's not a suspect in anything." "I'd appreciate it if you'd escort him to your location. He's in some danger." "Yeah? What kind of danger? Now we're talking danger." "I'm talking national security, and that's all I can say at this time." "Oh, now you're a Fed again." "No. I'm a cop in a bind. I need this, and I can't say why." "Okay. We'll put his picture on a milk carton. You have a photo?" I took a deep breath and said, "It's not much of a photo, and it's very old, and I don't want posters in his old neighborhood either. We're trying to catch the guy who's trying to find him, not scare the guy off, okay? By the way, I called the LA FBI office and Agent Sturgis, and they're working on this too. Whoever finds him first gets a gold medal." "Wow, why didn't you say so? We'll get right on it." "Cops can be pains in the ass." "But seriously, Lieutenant." "Okay, I'll work this one and give you a call." "Thanks." I gave him my and Kate's phone numbers. "How's the weather in New York?" "Snow and ice." "Figures." He hung up. Kate looked up from her computer and said to me, "You didn't have to be so secretive with our people or with the LAPD." "I wasn't secretive." "Yes, you were." "Well, it's not important that they know why. It's only important that they know who. Chip Wiggins is missing and needs to be found. That's all they need to know." "They'd be more motivated if they knew why." She was right, of course, but I was trying to think like a cop and act like a Fed, and all this national security crap was getting to me. Kate went back to her computer and said, "I'm not finding anything in any of the Burbank or LA area directories." "Tell the computer why you need to know." fuck off, John. She added, I am your boss. You'll keep me informed and listen to me. Wow. I replied in my I'm out of here tone, if you don't like the way I'm handling this case and you're not happy with my results so far. Okay, sorry. I'm just a little tense and tired. I was up all night. She smiled at me and winked. I sort of smiled back. Ms. Mayfield had a tough side, too, and I'd be well advised to remember that. I said to her, Sturgis says to say hello. She didn't reply but continued banging away at her computer and said, This guy could have moved to Nome, Alaska for all we know. I wish I had his social security number. Check your email to see if we have any message from DOD or the Air Force regarding the personnel files of those 8 guys. Yes, ma'am. I punched up my email, but aside from a lot of inter-office stuff, there was nothing there. I said to Kate, But now that we have some names, we can specifically ask the Air Force for the Wiggins file. Right. I'll do that. She got on the phone, and I heard her making her way through some bureaucracy or another. I said to no one in particular, I hope Asad Khalil is having as much trouble finding Wiggins as we are. I got into my computer and tried a few avenues on the information highway, including the Air Force website. There was an MIA and a KIA section, and incredibly I found Stephen Cox, killed in the Gulf War. But there was no section called Guys on Secret Missions. Kate put down her phone and announced, It may take a while to get Wiggins' file. The chip thing threw them. They want his service number or social security number. That's what we want. Right. I played with my computer, but aside from a good recipe for chocolate chip cookies, I wasn't getting much. I really prefer the telephone. Kate kept bugging me to call the counterterrorism office in D.C., and I kept putting it off because I knew it would be an hour conversation, followed by me on the shuttle to Washington. And in truth, with only one target still standing for Khalil, it was more important that I find Wiggins before Khalil did. There are lots of ways to find a missing Joe citizen in America. Land of record keeping, credit cards, driver's licenses, and all that. I've found people in less than an hour, though sometimes it can take a day or two. But sometimes you never find a person, even if that person was once Mr. Happy Homeowner with a wife and kids. All I had on this guy was a nickname, a last name, a last known address, and the fact that he'd served in the Air Force. I called the California Department of Motor Vehicles, and an unusually helpful civil servant gave me the name of an Elwood Wiggins in Burbank with the same last known address plus the date of birth. Voila. Now I had a name and a DOB that fit. I was getting a picture of this guy, Chip, and I pictured a jerk-off who was totally irresponsible about keeping the world informed as to his whereabouts. On the other hand, that might be keeping him alive. I said to Kate, Try Elwood from now on. That's on his driver's license. I added, DOB for Elwood is right for Chip, 1960. Not a son, not a father. Okay. She banged away at her computer, scanning telephone directories. I called the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office to see if a Mr. Elwood Chip Wiggins had done me the favor of dying naturally. A clerk there informed me that a number of Wigginses had passed on in the last year, but not Elwood. I said to Kate, Coroner's Office doesn't have a record of him. She said, You know, he could be out of L.A. County, out of the state, and out of the country. Try the Social Security Administration. I'd rather look for him on foot. I added, Anyway, they'll want a Social Security number. Try the Veterans Administration, John. You try. But I'll tell you, this character probably doesn't keep anyone informed. I wish we had a hometown for him. Notify Air Force personnel that we have the name Elwood and date of birth. That may help their computer. So we worked the phones and computers for the next half hour. I called LAPD missing persons again and gave them Elwood and the date of birth and did the same with my colleagues at the FBI LA office. But I was running out of clueless people to call. Finally, I had a thought and called Mrs. Rose Hambrecht. She answered the telephone and I reintroduced myself. She informed me, I've given all the information I had to a General Anderson from Wright-Patterson. Yes, ma'am. I don't have that information yet. But I have other information about the 8 men on that Al-Azizia mission, and I wanted to confirm some of it with you. Don't you people work in concert?
No.
Yes, ma'am, but it takes a while, and I'm trying to do my job as quickly.
What do you want?
Well, I'm focusing on one person, a man named Chip Wiggins.
Oh, Chip.
He's a real character.
Yes, ma'am.
Would you know if his first name is Elwood?
I never knew his real first name, only Chip.
Okay. I have a Burbank, California address for him. I read her the address and asked, is that what you have?
Let me get my phone book.
I held on while Mrs. Hambrecht went to find her phone book. I said to Kate, how are we doing there?
Nothing. John, it's time we turned this problem over to the whole ICC. We've already delayed too long.
I don't need 50 agents to call back the same people and agencies we've already called. If you need help, then you go ahead and put out an email or however you alert the troops. Meanwhile, I know how to find a fucking missing person.
Excuse me? Said Mrs. Hambrecht, who was back on the line.
What did you say?
Just clearing my throat.
I cleared my throat. She said, I have the same address you have.
Okay. Would you know Mr. Wiggins' hometown?
No. I don't know much about him. I only remember him from Lackenheath on our first tour of duty there in the 1980s.
He's a very irresponsible officer.
Yes, ma'am. But did Colonel Hambrecht keep in touch with him?
Yes, but not often. I know that they spoke last April on the anniversary of
Al Azizia.
Yes.
I asked her a few more questions, but she didn't know anything. Or like most people, she didn't think she knew anything. But you had to ask the right question.
Unfortunately, I didn't know the right question.
Kate was listening on the line now and discovered that I was starting to run out of even stupid questions, and she covered the phone and said to me,
ask her if she knows if he's married.
Who cares?
But I asked, do you know if he was married?
I don't think so. But he could have been. I've really told you all I know about him.
Okay, well,
Kate said,
what did he or does he do for a living?
I asked Mrs. Hambrecht, what did he or does he do for a living?
I don't...
Well, actually, I do recall that my husband said Chip took flying lessons and became a pilot.
He took flying lessons after he went on the bombing raid?
Isn't that a little late? I mean,
Chip Wiggins was not a pilot, Mrs. Hambrecht informed me coolly. He was a weapons officer. He dropped the bombs, and he navigated.
I see. So, he took flying lessons after he left the Air Force and became a cargo pilot, I believe.
Yes, he couldn't get a job with an airline, so he flew cargo. I remember that now.
Do you know what company he flew for?
No.
Like FedEx or UPS or one of the big ones?
I don't think so. That's all I know.
Well, thank you again, Mrs. Hambrecht. You've been very helpful. If you think of anything else regarding Chip Wiggins, please call me immediately. I again gave her my phone number. She asked me,
what is this all about?
What do you think?
I think someone is trying to kill the pilots who flew that mission, and they started with my husband.
Yes, ma'am.
My God.
Well, again, my condolences. I heard her say softly,
this isn't right. This isn't fair. Oh, poor William.
Please, be cautious yourself, just in case. Call the police and the FBI office closest to you. She didn't reply, but I could hear her crying. I didn't know what to say, so I hung up. Kate was already on another line, and she said to me,
I'm on with the FAA. They'll have a record of his pilot's license.
Right. I hope he updated that, at least. He'd better, or he'd be in trouble with them, too. I was glad it was still civil service business hours all over America, or we'd be sitting there playing computer games. Kate said into the phone,
yes, I'm still here.
Okay. She picked up a pen, which was hopeful, and wrote on a pad. She said,
as of when?
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you.
She hung up and said, "Ventura, that's a little north of Burbank. He sent a change of address about 4 weeks ago, but no phone number." She got online and announced to me, "He's not in the Ventura directory. I'll try an operator for directory assistance." She called directory assistance and gave them the name Elwood Wiggins. She hung up and said, "Unlisted number." "I'll have our office there get the number." I looked at my watch. This had taken about an hour and 15 minutes. If I'd gotten on the phone with Washington, I'd still be talking. I said to Kate, "Where's the closest FBI office to Ventura?" "There's a small resident agent office right in Ventura." She picked up the phone and said to me, "I hope we're not too late, and I hope they can set a trap for Khalil." "Yeah." I stood. "I'll be back in about 15 minutes. "Where are you going?" "Stein's office." "More cop stuff?" "Well, with Koenig over the Atlantic, Stein is the man." "Be right back." I hurried off, out of the ICC. I took the elevator up. Captain Stein's office was located in the southwest corner of the 28th floor, and I had no doubt it had the exact same number of square feet as Mr. Koenig's southeast office. I sort of barged past two secretaries and found myself in the middle of the room facing Captain Stein, who was sitting at his large desk talking on the telephone. He saw me and got off the phone. He said, "This has got to be important, Corey, or your ass is in a sling." He motioned me to a chair across from his desk, and I sat. We looked at each other, and we established that this was important. He opened his desk drawer, took out a seltzer bottle, and poured two vodkas in plastic cups. He handed one to me, and I drank about half of it. The federal angels wept somewhere. He took a slug himself and said, "What do we got?" "We got it all, Captain, or most of it, but we got it about 72 hours too late." "Then let's hear it." So I told him quickly, without regard to grammar or punctuation, cop to cop, if you will, my mouth in New York overdrive. He listened, nodded, made no notes, then sat there when I finished and thought for a while. Finally, he said, "Four dead?" "Five, counting Colonel Hambrecht. 14 counting everyone, not to mention everyone on board Transcontinental Flight 175. "That fuck." "Yes, sir." "We'll find this fuck." "Yes, sir." He thought a moment, then said, "And you didn't call anyone in Washington?" "No, sir. The call would be better coming from you." "Yeah." He thought a while longer, then said, "Well, I guess we have one or two chances to collar this guy, assuming he didn't already get to this guy Wiggins, or if he goes for Callum." "Right. But maybe he's done, or he thinks it's getting hot around here and he's out of the country already." "Possible." "Shit." Stein thought a moment and asked, "So the Ventura office is covering Wiggins' last known address. Kate is working on it. And this guy, Colonel Callum, is covered?" "Yes, sir." "Are the feds laying a trap for Khalil there?" "I believe they're just covering the Callums. I'm thinking if Khalil knows this guy is dying, why would he go for a dying man?" Stein replied, "If the dying man dropped a bomb on him, I think he would. I'll call the FBI in Denver and strongly suggest they set a trap." He finished his vodka, and I finished mine. I thought about asking for seconds. Captain Stein looked up at his high ceiling a while, then looked back at me and said, "You know, Corey, the Israelis took 18 years to settle the score for the Munich Olympic massacre in 1972. "Yes, sir." "The Germans released the captured terrorists in exchange for the release of a hijacked Lufthansa flight. The Israeli intelligence people systematically hunted down and assassinated each of those 7 Black September terrorists who massacred the Israeli athletes. They got the last one in 1991. "Yes, sir." "They play a different game in the Mideast. There's no clock on the field. Ever." "I see that." Stein stayed silent a half minute or so, then said, "Did we do everything we could?" "I think we did. I'm not sure about anyone else." He didn't reply to that, but said, "Hey, good work. You like it here?" "No." "What do you want?" back where I was. You can't go home again, my boy.
Sure I can.
I'll see what I can do. Meantime, you have enough riding to do to keep you busy through the weekend. I'll talk to you later.
He stood, and I stood.
He said, tell Ms. Mayfield I congratulate her, if it means anything, from a cop.
I'm sure it does.
Okay, I've got a lot of calls to make. Scram.
I didn't scram. I said, let me fly out to California.
Why?
I'd like to be in on the last act.
Yeah? There's an army of police and FBI there by now. They don't need you.
But I need to be there.
Why not Colorado Springs? I'm thinking geography. Colorado's on the way to California last time I checked.
I'm tired of chasing this asshole. I want to be ahead of him.
What if you go to California and the FBI nabs him in Colorado Springs?
I can live with that.
I doubt it.
Okay, go wherever you want to go.
You're better off out of here anyway.
I'll authorize it.
Use your own credit card to save time. Don't get yourself killed. You have reports to write.
Beat it before I change my mind.
I said, I'll take my partner along.
Whatever you want. You're the golden boy for the moment.
Hey, you watch the X-Files?
Sure do.
How come he's not fucking her?
Beats me.
Me too.
He put out his hand, and we shook. On my way out the door, he called after me. I'm proud of you, John. You're a good cop.
Captain Stein's office felt like a breath of fresh air in 26 Federal Plaza.
I went quickly back downstairs to the ICC, aware that I could be trapped here by a phone call or an FBI boss. I went directly to Kate's desk and said, let's go. I took her arm.
Where?
California.
Really? Now?
Right now.
She stood.
Do I need nothing, just your gun and shield?
Badge.
We say badge.
I say walk faster.
She kept up with me as I walked toward the elevators. She asked, who authorized?
Stein.
Okay.
She thought a moment, then said, maybe we should go to Colorado Springs.
Maybe we should. But I didn't want an argument from my lady boss, so I said, Stein only authorized California.
Why?
I don't know. I think he wants me as far away as possible. The elevator came, we got on and rode down to the lobby, then walked out to Broadway. I hailed a taxi and we both got in. I said to the driver, JFK. We pulled out into heavy downtown traffic. I said to Kate, what's the news from Ventura?
Well, our Ventura office got Wiggins' unlisted phone number and they called Wiggins' house while I was on the phone. They got his answering machine, but didn't leave a detailed message. They just told him to call them the minute he got the message. Then they sent some agents to his house, which they tell me is near the beach. Then they called for reinforcements from L.A. She added, there are only a few people in the Ventura office.
I hope they don't find him home and dead.
What do they plan to do? Surround the house with tanks?
We are not as stupid as you think, John.
That's reassuring.
They'll check his house, interview neighbors, and of course, lay a trap for Khalil.
I tried to picture a bunch of guys in blue suits running around a beachside neighborhood, knocking on doors and flashing Fed creds. That should cause a stampede of illegal aliens heading south. Meanwhile, if Asad Khalil was staking out the neighborhood, he might get a little suspicious. But to be fair, I wasn't sure how I'd handle this either.
I said to Kate, call Ventura again.
She took her cell phone and hit the buttons. The taxi was approaching the Brooklyn Bridge. I looked at my watch. It was just 3 p.m., noon in California.
Or was it the other way around?
I know it changes west of 11th Avenue. Kate said into the cell phone, this is Mayfield. Anything new?
She listened a while and said, okay, I'm flying to LAX. I'll call back later with my flight info. Meet me with a car at arrivals and get me to the police helipad. Meet me with a car wherever you intend to land me in Ventura.
Right.
I'm authorizing it.
Don't worry about it unless you don't do it. Then you have something to worry about.
She hung up and looked at me.
See? I can be an arrogant asshole like you. I smiled and asked her, "So what's new in Ventura?" Well, the three available Ventura agents got to Wiggins' house and they broke in on the possibility that he was dead inside, but he's not home. So they're in the house and they're using his phone book to call people where he might be or who might know where he is. If he's dead, he's not dead at home. Okay. He could be on a long flight. Could be. He flies for a living. Could be his day off. He could be at the beach. How's the weather in Ventura? It's always the same. Sunny and 72. She added, I put in 2 years with the LA office about 3 years ago. How'd you like it? It was okay. Not as interesting as New York. We both smiled. I asked her, where the hell is Ventura? She told me, but I didn't quite understand the geography or all the Spanish names she was throwing around. We were over the Brooklyn Bridge, and the cabbie got on the southbound BQE, which is the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway, and may have once moved cars in an express-like fashion, but I've never seen that, except at 3 a.m. I flashed the Fed creds and said to the driver, step on it. I always say that even when I'm not late and I don't know where I'm going. I asked the cabbie where he was from, and he told me he was from Jordan. That was a new one. Pakistan is way ahead, but Macedonia is starting to catch up. I said to Kate, Stein said to congratulate you. She didn't reply. I said, there's an outside chance I can get back on the job on the police force. Again, no reply. So I changed the subject and asked her, where do you think Khalil is? California, Colorado Springs, or in transit? Maybe. But maybe he only worked the East Coast where he has some assets, then he got out, maybe with the help of some Mideast embassy. California and Colorado are a long way off. John, this guy didn't come halfway across the world to... She glanced at the taxi driver and said, to eat part of a meal, you know that. Right. But I'm wondering how he's getting to L.A. The airports are dangerous for him. The big ones are. I once had a fugitive who went from L.A. to Miami via small airports. He could have walked it faster, but he managed to give us the slip until we caught up with him in Miami. Right. And don't forget a private charter. I had a drug king once who chartered a private jet. A lot of them do that. No security points, no records of their flight, and they can go anywhere they can land. Maybe we should alert the local airports in the Ventura area. I suggested that to the Ventura office. They reminded me that there are dozens of small airports in the area, dozens more close by, and a private aircraft can land 24 hours a day at most of them. You'd need an army to watch every general aviation facility, not to mention abandoned or unmanned landing fields. I guess. Kate seemed to know this stuff better than I did. I do cabs and subways. Half of my fugitives wind up going to their mother's house or their girlfriend's apartment or hanging around their favorite saloon. Most criminals, especially murderers, are really stupid. I like the smart ones better. They give me a little challenge and a lot of entertainment. I said to Kate, Khalil pulled this off because of speed, like a purse snatcher. He's no idiot, and he knows that we'd be onto his game within 3, maybe 4 days. That's optimistic. Well, we got onto him in less than 4 days, right? Okay, and? And? I don't know. Wiggins is either dead already or he's someplace else. Like maybe he flew cargo to the East Coast and Khalil knew this and nailed him already. Those agents in his house might be there for a long time waiting for Wiggins or Khalil to show up. Possible. You have any other ideas? You want to stay here in New York? You can go to that 5 o'clock meeting and listen to everyone tell you how brilliant you are. That's a cheap shot. And you don't want to miss the 8 o'clock meeting tonight with Jack when he returns from Frankfurt. I didn't reply. What do you want to do, John? I don't know. This guy has me a little baffled. I'm trying to put myself in his head. Do you want my opinion? Sure. I say we go to California. You said go to Frankfurt. I never said that. What do you want to do? call Ventura again. They have my cell phone number. They'll call me if anything develops. Call Denver. Why don't you buy your own cell phone? She dialed the Denver FBI office and asked for an update. She listened, thanked them, and hung up. She said to me, "The Callums have been taken to housing at the Air Force Academy. We have agents staking out their off-post residence and waiting inside, same as Ventura." Okay. We were on the Belt Parkway now, heading for Kennedy Airport. I was trying not to second-guess myself, trying to stay on the roll I was on without blowing it at the end. It was not easy being the man of the hour. Normally, I wouldn't confide all these doubts to anyone, but Kate and I were more than partners now. I said to her, "Call the L.A. office and tell them to put a watch on consulate offices of countries that might help Khalil effect an escape. Also, make sure they're watching Wiggins' former Burbank house in case Khalil has old information and shows up there." I did that while you were talking to Stein. They informed me they already knew what to do. Get a little respect for the FBI, John. You're not the only genius in law enforcement. I thought I was. But I guess I'm not alone. Still, there was something bothering me about how this was playing out. I was missing something, and I knew that I knew what it was, but I couldn't think of what it was. I ran the whole thing through my mind, from Saturday to now, but whatever it was kept slipping away into a dark corner of my mind, not unlike how Asad Khalil kept slipping away. Kate was on her cell phone to the woman at Fed Plaza who makes travel arrangements and was saying we needed info on first available nonstop flights to LAX and to Denver. She listened, glanced at her watch, then said, "Hold on." She said to me, "Where would you like to go?" "Where Khalil is going." "Where is he going?" "L.A. She got back on the phone and said, "Okay, Doris, can you book the American flight?" "No, I don't have an authorization number." She looked at me and I pulled out my credit card. Kate took it and said to Doris, "We'll pay and put in for reimbursement." She gave Doris my credit card info and added, "Make it first class, and please call the LA office and advise them of our arrival. Thanks." She handed me my card. "For you, John, they'll pick up first class." That may be true today, but by tomorrow they may not even pick up this cab ride. The government loves you. Where have I failed? Anyway, we got to JFK, and the driver said, "Which terminal?" This is where I came in on Saturday with the same question. But this time I wasn't going to the Conquistador Club. Kate said to the driver, "Terminal 9. We got to the American Airlines terminal, got out, I paid the cab, and we went inside to the ticket counter where we got two first-class tickets in exchange for my available credit. We ID'd ourselves and filled out Form SS-113 that identified our carry-on luggage as two Glock 40-caliber automatic pistols. We had 15 minutes to catch the flight, and I suggested a quick drink. But Kate looked at the departure board and said, "They're boarding now. We'll get a drink on board." "We're carrying. Trust me, I've done this before." Indeed, there was another side to Pauly Perfect which hadn't been revealed to me heretofore. So we flashed the creds and the firearm boarding pass at the security point and got to the gate with minutes to spare. The first-class flight attendant was in her late 70s or thereabouts, and she put her dentures in her mouth and welcomed us aboard. I asked her, "Is this a local or an express train?" She seemed confused, and I recalled that seniority sometimes equaled senility. Anyway, I was out of airline jokes, so we gave them our firearm boarding passes, and she looked at me as though wondering how I'd been licensed to carry. Kate gave her a reassuring smile. But perhaps this was all my imagination. The flight attendant checked her manifest to assure herself of our identity, then went into the cockpit with the boarding passes, as per regulations, to inform the captain that two armed law enforcement people were on board, a nice lady and a weirdo, traveling together in first class. We found our seats, two bulkhead seats on the port side. First class was half full, mostly people who looked like Angelinos going home where they belonged. Well, we weren't tarmacked too long, considering this was JFK, and we took off only 15 minutes late, which the captain said we'd make up in the air. which is better, I guess, than making it up on the ground at LAX by taxiing to the gate at 600 miles an hour while deploying the emergency chutes. So off we went, into the wild blue yonder, armed, motivated, and hopeful. I said to Kate, I forgot to buy clean underwear. I was about to mention that. Ms. Mayfield was in a rare mood. Another first-class flight attendant came around with newspapers, and I asked for the Long Island Newsday. I looked for and found a story about the Cradle of Aviation murders, which I read with interest. I noticed that this major Long Island story had no byline, which is sometimes a tip-off that the authorities were managing the story a little. In fact, there was no mention of Asad Khalil, and the motive for the murders was described as a possible robbery. Right. Standard armed robbery of a museum. I wondered if anyone was buying the museum robbery homicide story. Specifically, I was wondering if Khalil would buy it if he saw it and believed that we were clueless. Worth a try, I guess. I showed the story to Kate, who read it, and said, Khalil left a very clear message in that museum. That means he may be finished and heading home, or he has tremendous arrogance and contempt for the authorities, and he's saying, you won't figure this out until it's too late. Catch me if you can. She thought a moment, then said, I hope it's the latter, and I hope he's going where we're going. If he is, he's probably there already. I just hope he's waiting until dark to make his next move. She nodded. Well, I needed a little drink or two, so I asked Kate to sweet-talk the grandma, flight attendant, into alcoholic beverages. Kate informed me she won't serve us. We're armed.
I thought you said...
I lied. I'm a lawyer. I said, trust me. That means I'm lying. How stupid can you be? She laughed. I was stunned. She said, have a root beer. I'm going to have a fit. She took my hand. I calmed down and ordered a Virgin Mary. The first-class meal wasn't too bad, and the movie starring John Travolta playing an Army CID guy was terrific. Despite a bad review that I recalled reading in Long Island's Newsday, written by John Anderson, a so-called movie critic whose opinion I trusted to be the exact opposite of mine. Kate and I held hands during the movie just like kids in a theater. When the movie ended, I put my seat back and fell asleep. As often happens, I had a revealing dream about what I couldn't think of when I was awake. I mean, the whole thing just came to me. What Khalil was up to, where he was going next, and what we had to do to catch him. Unfortunately, when I woke up, I forgot most of the dream, including the brilliant conclusions I'd come to. It's sort of like having a great sex dream and waking up realizing you still had a Woody. But I digress. We landed at LAX at 7:30 p.m., and for better or worse, we were in California. This was either where we needed to be, or it wasn't. We'd soon find out. Book 5. California, the Present. Go then, and slay a man I shall name. When you return, my angels shall bear thee again to paradise. And should you die, nevertheless, they will carry you to paradise. The Old Man of the Mountain, a 13th century prophet and founder of the Assassins. Chapter 47. We deplaned first, went outside, and were met by an FBI guy from the Los Angeles office who drove us to the police heliport where a waiting FBI helicopter flew us to Ventura, wherever the hell that is. Everything on the ground looked like Queens, except for the palm trees and the mountains. We flew a few miles out over some ocean, I guess, then along the coastline with some hefty hills just to our right. The sun sat right above the ocean, but instead of rising like it does on my ocean, it was setting. Is this place weird or what? Within 25 minutes, we landed at a heliport at the community hospital on the east side of Ventura. A blue Crown Victoria sedan was waiting for us, driven by a guy named Chuck. Chuck was dressed in tan pants and a sports coat and wore running shoes. Chuck claimed to be an FBI agent, but looked like a parking attendant. FBI, California version. but they all think the same because they all attended the same Manchurian candidate school at Quantico. Chuck asked us lots of questions as he drove us to the Ventura sub-office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I guess they don't handle that many international terrorist mass murder cases in Ventura. In fact, Kate had mentioned on the plane that this office had been closed once and recently reopened for some reason. The office was located in a sort of modern office building surrounded by palm trees and parking lots. As we walked through the parking lot, I looked around. I smelled flowers in the air, and the temperature and humidity were perfect. The sun had almost set, but there was still a glow in the sky. I asked Kate, "What does the FBI do here? Grow avocados?" "Adjust your attitude." "Sure." I pictured the agents here with blue Brooks Brothers suits, sandals, and no socks. Anyway, we went into the building up an elevator and found a door that said Federal Bureau of Investigation. They had their round coat of arms on the door, too, which said Justice Department, and showed the standard scales of justice, balanced, not tipped, and the motto, fidelity, bravery, integrity. Can't argue with that, but I said to Kate, they should add politically correct. She'd gotten into the habit of ignoring me and rang the buzzer. The door opened and we were met by a nice lady agent named Cindy Lopez, who said, "Nothing new. We have three Ventura agents in the Wiggins house, joined by three agents from the LA office. There are 24 LA and Ventura agents in the neighborhood. The local police have been alerted, and everyone is in radio and cell phone contact. We're still trying to locate Elwood Wiggins. We discovered from papers in his house that he flies for Pacific Cargo Services, and we visited them, but they informed us he's not scheduled to fly until Friday. But they mentioned he sometimes calls in sick on Friday. We have two agents at Pacific Cargo at Ventura County Airport in the event he shows up there. We've also assigned agents to locations where he's known to frequent. But we're developing a picture of this man as a free spirit whose movements are erratic. I like this guy." Agent Lopez sort of smiled and continued, "His girlfriend is also missing. They are both known to be campers, and it's very possible they're camping." "What's camping?" I asked. Ms. Lopez looked at Ms. Mayfield. Ms. Mayfield looked at me. I said, "Oh, like in the woods, tents and all that." "Yes." "Do you have a cell phone number for Wiggins or the girlfriend?" "Yes, for both, but no one answers." I thought a moment and decided that camping out was better than being dead, but not by much. I said to Ms. Lopez, "It sounds like you did a thorough job." "I'm sure we have." She handed Kate a message slip and said, "Jack Koenig called from New York. He'd like you to call him back. He'll be there until midnight New York time, then home." I said to Kate, "We'll call him from the Wiggins house when we have something to report." She said, "We'll call now." "How'd you like to be talking to Jack here when Khalil shows up at the Wiggins house?" She nodded reluctantly and said to Cindy Lopez, "Okay, we'd like to go out to Wiggins' house. We're trying not to show too much activity there." I replied, "Then we'll sit quietly on the couch." She hesitated, then said, "If you go, we would appreciate it if you stayed at least until the early morning hours." She said pointedly, "We're trying to set a trap, not have an open house party." I wanted to remind her that none of us would be at this juncture if it weren't for moi, but I resisted saying the obvious. You see how quickly a case can get away from you? Kate, always the diplomat, replied to Agent Lopez, "You're in charge, and we're not here to get in the way." Leaving Ms. Lopez to wonder why we were there. "It's all ego, lady." I said, "Ms. Mayfield and I began this case with the tragedy at Kennedy Airport, so we'd like to see it through. We'll stay out of the way when we get to the Wiggins house." I didn't think she believed me, but she said, "I would advise you to wear body armor. I have extras here I can loan you." I had the urge to strip and show Ms. Lopez the bullets just passed through me with no effect. I said, "Thank you," but Kate interrupted, "Thank you, we'll borrow the body armor." She informed Ms. Lopez, "Never ask a man if he wants a bulletproof vest or a pair of mittens, just make him put it on." Ms. Lopez smiled knowingly. Well, I was feeling really special now, surrounded by nurturing, caring females who knew what was best for dopey little Johnny. But then I thought about Asad Khalil, and I hoped they had a vest in my size. So off we went into their locked armament room behind a steel door. Inside the room were all the goodies: rifles, shotguns, stun grenades, handcuffs, and so on. Ms. Lopez said, "You can try the vests on in the men's and ladies' room if you wish." Kate thanked Agent Lopez as she left. I took off my tie, jacket, and shirt and said to Kate, "I won't peek." She took off her Heinz ketchup jacket and her blouse, and I peeked. We both found our size and strapped on the body armor. I said, "This is just like that scene in the X-Files." "Stop with the fucking X-Files." "But it doesn't it bug you that those two never get it on?" "She doesn't love him. She respects him, and he respects her, and they don't want to lose or complicate that special relationship of trust." "Say again." "Personally, I think they should be fucking by now." We exited the armory and thanked Agent Lopez. Chuck, who had picked us up at the community hospital heliport, escorted us back out to the parking lot and drove us toward the house of Mr. Elwood Chip Wiggins. A lot of thoughts ran through my mind as the car moved west toward the left coast. I'd come a long way to be here, but Mr. Asad Khalil had come a much longer way. His journey had begun in a place called Al-Azizia, somewhere in Libya, a long time ago. He and Chip Wiggins had, for a few brief minutes, shared a point in space and time on the night of April 15, 1986. Now Asad Khalil wanted to repay the visit, and Mr. Wiggins didn't know he had company calling. Or Chip Wiggins had already met Asad Khalil and the business was finished. In that case, no one would show up at the Wiggins house ever. But if Wiggins and Khalil had not yet met, I wondered who would be the first to come walking up the driveway. The sunlight was almost gone and the streetlights had come on. As we approached Wiggins' neighborhood, Chuck radioed ahead to the stakeout units around Wiggins' house so that they didn't get nervous or trigger happy. Chuck then used his cell phone to call the agents inside the Wiggins' house for the same reason, and I said, "Tell them to put the coffee on." Chuck didn't pass this along, and I could tell by his end of the phone conversation that the agents in the house weren't thrilled about the unexpected company. Fuck 'em. It's still my case. Anyway, we drove through the long, straight streets of a suburban neighborhood that Chuck said was near the ocean, though I didn't see or smell the ocean. All the houses were on undersized lots, and the houses themselves were all single-story stucco boxes with attached garages and red-tile roofs, plus at least one palm tree per house. It didn't seem to be an expensive neighborhood, but in California there was no way to tell, and neither did I care. I said to Chuck, "Were these houses always here, or did they come down in a mudslide from the mountains?" Chuck chuckled and replied, "They slid down from the last earthquake, which preceded the wildfires." I liked Chuck. Happily, I didn't spot any of the stakeout units, and more happily, I didn't spot any kids around. Chuck said, "That's the house on the right, second from the cross street." "You mean the white stucco with the red tile roof and the palm tree?" "Yeah, they all... second from the end." Kate, riding in the rear, kicked the back of my seat, which was some sort of signal, I guess. Chuck said, "I'll stop, you exit, and off I go. Front door is unlocked." I'd noticed when I got in the car that the interior lights had been disconnected, just like on the East Coast, which was reassuring. It was possible these people knew what they were doing. The car stopped, Kate and I got out quickly and without running moved up the broken concrete walkway. To the right of the door was a large picture window with the Venetian blinds shut. In my old neighborhood, the whole block would have been hip to the strange goings-on by this time, but this block looked like a scene from a 1950s B-movie where everyone is dead from atomic radiation. Or maybe the feds had evacuated the neighborhood. So I opened the door and in we went. There was no foyer, and we found ourselves in a combination L-shaped living room-dining room, lit only by a single dim table lamp. A man and a woman stood in the middle of the room wearing blue slacks and shirts, FBI nylon windbreakers with creds attached. They had big grins on their faces, and their hands were outstretched in greeting. Not really. The man did say, "I'm Roger Fleming, and this is Kim Ree." Ms. Ree was Oriental, now called East Asian, and by her name I guessed she was of Korean ethnicity. Roger was white bread and mayonnaise. I said, I guess you know our names. I'm the one called Kate. Agent Fleming did not smile, and neither did Agent Ree. Some people get all serious when they're waiting around for a deadly shootout. Cops tend to yuck it up, probably to cover their nervousness, but the feds take everything seriously, including, I'm sure, a day at the beach. Agent Ree inquired, how long will you be staying? I replied, as long as it takes. Kate said, we don't intend to become involved with the actual apprehension of the suspect if he shows up here unless you need us. We're here only to help identify him and to take a statement after he's apprehended. Also, we will escort him back to New York or Washington to answer a variety of federal charges. That wasn't exactly what I had in mind, but it was good for Fleming and Ree to hear that one of us was sane. Ms. Mayfield continued her mission statement and said, if Mr. Wiggins shows up first, then we'll interview him and ask that he turn over the premises to us, then someone here can escort him to another location. In either case, we intend to remain in this house waiting for the suspect, who we believe is headed this way. Ms. Ree replied, we have determined that 6 is the optimum number of agents we want in the house for safety and logistical reasons. So if the suspect shows up at this location, we'll ask you to take a position in a back room, which we'll show you. I said, look, Ms. Ree, Mr. Fleming, we could all be here a long time, sharing the bathroom and bedroom, so why don't we cut the shit and try to get along, okay? No response. Kate, to her credit, changed her tone and said, we've worked this case since Asad Khalil landed in New York. We've seen over 300 dead people aboard the aircraft he arrived in. We've had a member of our team murdered, our secretary murdered, and the duty officer murdered. And so on. She put it to them, too nicely, I thought, but they got the message and actually nodded when Kate was finished. Meanwhile, I looked around the living room, which was sparse yet tasteless. Also untidy, which I'd like to blame on the feds, but which I thought was probably a reflection of Mr. Wiggins' attitude toward life. Ms. Ree offered to introduce us to her colleagues, and we followed her into her kitchen, where Mr. Fleming took up his position at the front picture window, peering through the Venetian blinds. High tech. But of course, someone on stakeout would tip us if anyone approached the house. The kitchen was dimly lit by a soft fluorescent bulb under a cabinet, but I could see that the kitchen was circa 1955, and in it were another man and woman, also wearing the Urban Commando outfit of dark trousers, dark blue shirts, and nylon windbreakers. Their blue baseball caps sat on the counter. The man was seated at the small kitchen table, reading a stack of case reports with a flashlight. The woman was positioned at the back door, peering through the small door window. Ms. Ree introduced us to the gentleman, whose name, like my own, was Juan, although his last name was a mouthful of Spanish that I didn't catch. The lady was black, and her name was Edie. She gave us a wave as she continued to scope out the backyard. We next went back through the L-shaped area and through a door into a small foyer, off of which were 3 doors, the smaller leading to a bathroom. In the larger of the rooms, a bedroom, a man dressed in a suit sat at a computer station and monitored his radio and 2 cell phones, while he played with Mr. Wiggins' PC. The only light in the room came from the monitor screen, and all the blinds were shut. Ms. Ree made the introductions, and the guy whose name was Tom Stockwell, and whose ethnicity was pale, said to us, I'm out of the LA office, and I'm the case agent for this detail. I guess that left me out. I decided to be nice and said to Tom, Ms. Mayfield and I are here to help without being intrusive. How's that? He replied, how long are you staying? As long as it takes. Kate briefed Tom by saying, the suspect, as you should know, could be wearing body armor, and he has in his possession at least 2 weapons, 40 caliber Glocks, which, like the body armor, he apparently took from the 2 agents on board the aircraft. She gave Tom a verbal report, and he listened attentively. She concluded with, this man is extremely dangerous, and we don't expect taking him without a fight. But of course, we need to take him alive. Tom replied, we have various non-lethal weapons and devices, such as the goo gun and the projectile net, plus, of course, gas and... Excuse me? I said. What's a goo gun? It's a big handheld device that squirts this goo that hardens immediately and immobilizes a person. Is this a California thing? No, Mr. Corey. It's available nationwide. Tom added, and we also have a net which we can fire and which ensnares the individual. Really? Do you have real guns, too? Tom ignored me and continued his briefing. I interrupted and asked, have you evacuated the neighborhood? He replied, we went through a lot of debate about that, but Washington agrees that to try to evacuate the neighborhood could be a problem. For whom? He explained, first of all, there's the obvious problem of agents being seen making the notifications. Some people aren't home and may come home later, so this could take all night, and the residents would be inconvenienced if they had to leave their homes for an indefinite period. He added, we did, however, evacuate the houses on both sides and the back of this one, and there are agents in place at those houses. The subtext here was that it was more important to capture Asad Khalil than it was to worry about taxpayers getting caught in a crossfire. I couldn't honestly say I disagreed with this. Ms. Ree added, the stakeout people are instructed not to try to apprehend the suspect on the street unless he senses danger and attempts to flee. Most likely, the apprehension will take place in or near this house. The suspect is most probably alone and most probably armed with only two handguns, so we don't expect there to be a large exchange of gunfire, or any gunfire, if we play it right. She looked at Kate and me and said, the block will be sealed off to traffic if we determine that the suspect is approaching. I personally thought the neighbors wouldn't even notice if there was a wild shootout on the front lawn if they had their TVs and stereos turned up loud enough. I said, I agree, for what it's worth. But I had this mental image of a kid riding by on a bicycle at the worst possible moment. It happens. Boy, does it happen. Kate said, I assume the stakeout people have night vision devices? Of course. So we chatted a while, and Kate made sure to tell Tom and Kim that she was once a California girl herself, and everyone agreed that we all had our acts together, except perhaps me, who felt a bit like the odd man out here. Tom mentioned that Wiggins' former house in Burbank was also occupied and staked out by the FBI, and he informed us that the local police here and in Burbank were alerted but not asked for direct assistance. At some point, I got tired of hearing how everything was covered nine ways from Sunday, and I asked, where's your sixth person? In the garage. The garage is very cluttered, so Wiggins can't pull his car in there, but the door has an automatic opener, so Wiggins may enter that way on foot and come into the kitchen through the connecting door. That's probably what he'll do, since it's closest to where he'll pull his car into the driveway. I yawned. I was a little jet-lagged, I guess, and I hadn't had much sleep in the last few days. What time was it in New York? Later? Earlier? Tom also assured us that every effort was being made to locate Elwood Wiggins before he headed back to this house. He said, for all we know, Khalil could try to take him while he's driving home. Wiggins drives a purple Jeep Grand Cherokee, which is not here, so we're alert for that vehicle. I asked, what does the girlfriend drive? Tom replied, a white Ford Windstar, which is still at the girlfriend's house in Oxnard, which is also under surveillance. Oxnard? Anyway, what could I say? These people had their act together, professionally speaking. Personally, I still thought they were dweebs. I said, I'm sure you've been briefed about Khalil's prior visits to Wiggins' now-deceased squadron mates. This indicates to me that Khalil may have more information about Chip Wiggins than we do. He's been looking for Wiggins a lot longer than we have. I added, for the record, there's a strong possibility that Mr. Wiggins and Mr. Khalil have already met. No one commented on that for a few seconds, then Tom said, that doesn't change our job here. We wait and see if anyone shows up. He added, there's an area-wide alert for Khalil and for Wiggins, of course, so we may get a happy call from the police telling us that one or the other or both have been found. Wiggins alive and Khalil in cuffs. I didn't want to be the bearer of further bad karma, but I couldn't picture Asad Khalil in cuffs. Tom sat back at Wiggins' PC and said, I'm trying to get a clue as to where Wiggins might be from his computer. I've checked his email to see if he corresponded with a state or national park or reserved a camping space, something like that. We think he's camping, he said, I guess to me. That's where you go out into the woods with a tent or a camper. I concluded that Ms. Lopez and Tom had spoken. I asked Tom, have you checked out Wiggins' underwear? He looked at me from his computer. Excuse me? If he wears medium boxers, I'd like to borrow a pair. Tom thought about this a moment, then replied, we've all brought changes of clothing, Mr. Corey. Perhaps someone, one of the men, I mean, can loan you a pair of shorts. He added, you can't use Mr. Wiggins' underwear. Well, I'll ask him directly if he shows up. Good idea. Kate, to her credit, wasn't trying to pretend she didn't know me. She said to Kim Ree, we'd like to see the garage and the rest of the house. Ms. Ree led us into the foyer and opened the door of a room that faced the backyard. The room, formerly a bedroom probably, was now an entertainment center that held a huge television, audio equipment, and enough speakers to start another earthquake. On the floor, I noticed 6 overnight bags. Ms. Ree said, you can use this room later. The couch pulls out into a bed. She added, we'll all take turns getting some sleep if this goes through the night. I used to think that my worst nightmare was Thanksgiving dinner with my family, but being trapped in a small house with FBI agents just took first place. Ms. Ree also showed us the small bathroom, leading me to wonder if she'd once been a realtor. One thing I noticed that was missing from this house was any military memorabilia, which indicated to me that Elwood Wiggins did not want to be reminded of his service. Or maybe he just lost everything, which would be consistent with a profile we developed on him. Or maybe we had the wrong house. It wouldn't be the first time the feds got the address wrong. I thought about mentioning this last possibility to Ms. Ree, but this is a touchy subject with them. Anyway, we went back to the kitchen and Ms. Ree opened a door that revealed a cluttered garage. Sitting in a lawn chair behind some stacked cardboard boxes was a suntanned, blonde-haired young man, obviously the junior agent, reading a newspaper by the light of the overhead fluorescent bulb. He stood, and Ms. Ree motioned him back in his seat so that he was out of sight if the garage door suddenly opened electronically. She said to Kate and me, this is Scott, who volunteered for garage duty. She actually smiled. Scott, who looked like he'd just stepped off a surfboard, flashed his capped teeth and waved. I said, like, yeah, dude, hang in there, you know? Of course, I didn't say that, but I really wanted to. Scott was my size, but he didn't look like the boxer shorts type. Ms. Ree closed the door and we stood in the kitchen with Edie and Juan. Ms. Ree said, we've stocked some frozen and canned food here so that no one has to come or go if this lasts a while. She added, pointedly, we have 6 days of food for 6 people. I had a sudden image of FBI agents turning cannibal when the food ran out, but I didn't share this thought. I was already on thin ice, or the California equivalent. Juan said, now that we have 2 more mouths to feed, let's order pizza. I need my pizza. Juan was okay, I decided. Unfortunately, he was a lot heftier than me and also not the boxer shorts type. Edie said to me, I cook a mean microwaved macaroni and cheese. We all chuckled. This sucked. But so far, it was turning out a hell of a lot better than I could have expected 24 hours ago. Asad Khalil was within our grasp, right? What could go wrong? Don't ask. But at least if Wiggins was still alive, he had a good chance of staying alive. Kate said she was going to call Jack Koenig and invited me to join her in the back room. I declined the opportunity, and she went off. I stayed in the kitchen, chatting with Edie and Juan. Kate returned about 15 minutes later and informed me, Jack says hello and congratulations on a good piece of detective work. He wishes us luck. That's nice. Did you ask him how Frankfurt was? We did not discuss Frankfurt. Where's Ted Nash? Who cares? I do. Kate glanced at our colleagues and said softly, Don't obsess on things of no importance. I just want to punch him in the nose. No big deal. She ignored this and said, Jack wants us to call him if something develops, of course. We're authorized to escort Khalil dead or alive to New York rather than Washington. That's a major coup. I think Jack is counting his chickens before they're caught and cooked. Again, she ignored me and said, He's working with various local police forces to put together a clear picture of Asad Khalil's movements, his murders, and who his accomplices are or might have been. Good. That will keep him busy and off my back. That's exactly what I told him. I think Ms. Mayfield was joshing me. Anyway, we didn't want to amuse our colleagues any further, so we ended the conversation. Edie offered us coffee, and Kate, Kim, and I sat at the kitchen table with Edie while Juan watched the back door. They were all very interested in everything that had happened since Saturday, asking us questions about things that hadn't appeared in the news or in their reports. They were curious about what the mood was at 26 Federal Plaza and what the bosses in Washington were saying and all that. Law enforcement people, I decided, were the same all over, and despite the initial politely masked hostility upon our arrival, we were all getting along well, bonding and all that good stuff. I thought about leading everyone in a chorus of Ventura Highway or maybe California Here I Come, but I didn't want to overdo this West Coast moment. It seemed that everyone knew I was ex-NYPD, so I guess they'd been warned, if that's the right word, or perhaps they just figured it out. It was one of those times when things seem calm and normal, but everyone knows that a ringing telephone could stop the show and make your blood run cold. I've been there, and so had everyone else in that house. I guess I must thrive on this stuff because I wasn't thinking about my nice, safe classroom at John Jay. I was thinking of Asad Khalil, and I could almost taste the murdering bastard. In fact, I thought of Colonel Hambrecht being chopped to death with an axe, and the school kids in Brussels. An hour went by, and the five agents took turns alternating guard posts. Kate and I volunteered to relieve them, but they seemed to want us in the kitchen. Scott was at the table now and wanted to know about New York City. I tried to convince him that people surfed in the East River, and everyone chuckled. I was tempted to tell my attorney general joke, but it might be taken wrong. Anyway, I was being modest about my contributions to the case, hardly mentioning that I'd figured out what Asad Khalil was up to, and glossing over my blinding brilliance regarding identifying the pilots who were marked for death. On this subject, everyone was sort of glum, realizing that a lot of good guys who had served their country were now dead, murdered by a foreign agent. This was not supposed to happen. It was close to 9 p.m. when a phone rang somewhere, and the talk stopped. Tom came into the kitchen within seconds and said, There's a blue delivery van cruising the neighborhood, single male occupant driving. The guys with the night vision say he fits the description of the suspect. Everyone take their posts. Everyone was already up and moving, and Tom said to Kate and me, Go into the TV room. He quickly left the kitchen as Kim Ree went into the garage where Roger Fleming was now pulling duty. She left the door open, and I could see Roger crouched behind the cardboard boxes with his gun drawn. Kim pulled her piece and went to the garage door and stood to the side next to the lighted electric door opener. Juan was at the back kitchen door, gun drawn, standing off to the side. Kate and I went to the living room where Tom and Edie stood, guns drawn on both sides of the front door. Scott was standing in front of the door, peering through the peephole. I couldn't help noticing that Scott had all his clothes off, except for a pair of baggy bathing trunks, in the back of which protruded the butt of a Glock. I guess this was the California version of undercover. In any case, I gave the guy credit for not wearing a bulletproof vest. Tom saw us and again strongly suggested we retreat into the TV room, but he figured out quickly that we hadn't come 3,000 miles to watch TV while the bus went down. He said, Take cover over here. Kate moved beside Tom, who was to the left of the door, and drew her piece. I moved beside Edie, who was wedged against a small space between the door and the right-hand wall of the living room. The door would open toward us, and we would be behind it as it opened. There were enough guns drawn, so I didn't draw my Glock. I looked at Kate, who looked back at me, smiled, and winked. My heart was pounding, but not, I'm afraid, for Kate Mayfield. Tom had the cell phone to his ear, and he was listening. He said to us, "The van is slowing down a few doors away." Scott, at the peephole, said, "I see it. He's stopping in front of the house." You could hear the breathing in the room, and despite all the backup and all the high-tech stuff and the bulletproof vests, there's still nothing quite like the moment when you're about to come face-to-face with an armed killer. Scott, pretty cool, I thought, said, "A guy is getting out of the van. Street side, can't see him. He's going to the rear, opening the doors. He's got a package. Coming this way. Fits the description, tall, Mideastern type, wearing jeans and a dark collared shirt.